You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of The Unsinkable Kathy Bates by David Canfield. Bates committed and always collaborated with an intense, invigorating focus. I remember her calling me one evening to ask whether she could alter the preposition to on, Payne says. I glanced at the script and saw to my horror that she'd found a typo. This echoes Snyder Ehrman's experience with Bates on Matlock. She comes into the edit after I do my cut and watches and gives me ideas. If there's a false note in a script, she's going to find it. Bates found her first great post-Misery role in another Stephen King adaptation, Taylor Hackford's decades-spanning Dolores Claiborne, 1995, giving one of her deepest, most haunting performances as a woman accused of murder. She credits her success in the movie in part to the movement coach, dialect coach, and star hair and makeup team that were hired as she requested. It's like veterinary medicine. Each part is a different animal, Bates says. You've got to figure out where the tail is, where the heart is, all that stuff. In the late 90s, colleagues increasingly took note of Bates's sharp filmmaking instincts. Bates received her second Oscar nomination for 1998's Primary Colors, the Clinton campaign-inspired political drama, and she helped director Mike Nichols in choreographing a complex scene involving the results of a bombshell paternity test. In Titanic, meanwhile, Bates portrayed the unsinkable socialite Molly Brown, who at one point encourages Kate Winslet's Rose to join her elitist mother, Ruth, Frances Fisher, on a lifeboat to safety, leaving behind some less fortunate, effectively doomed passengers. Rose is reluctant, though, and ultimately stays behind. Working out how to approach the scene, Winslet turned to Bates. Kate came over to me and she said, "Can you just give me an idea of this?" And I said, "Give me a minute," Bates says. When I came back from thinking, I said, "This is the first and last time she's going to see her family for who they really are." Around this time, Bates got into directing and received an Emmy nomination for helming the 1999 A&E biopic Dash and Lily. She also served as one of the primary directors on the early seasons of the sprawling family saga 6 Feet Under. Bates may have been on the precipice of a great career behind the camera, but it stalled after her diagnosis of ovarian cancer in 2003. It just changed everything. Something broke. I stopped that whole year, she says. Then I needed to make money, and I couldn't make money directing. You don't get paid the same. She was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2012, just after the cancellation of her short-lived legal drama Harry's Law, and underwent a double mastectomy. The silver lining of that scary period for Bates, 10 pounds were gone, 5 each, you know. She now seems healthier than ever. It's been about 20 years since Bates' last credit as director, but she aims to helm an upcoming episode of Matlock's second season and is already intricately involved in the making of the show. In my private time, I call her the Energizer Bunny. "I literally have never seen anything like it," says Sam Anderson, who plays her husband on the show. He first met Bates in an acting class 40 years ago and remembers her as a sieve, taking in every bit of knowledge and using whatever she could to sharpen her craft. Now, as an executive producer and number one on the call sheet, she still does, while also advocating for every other creative on set. She tells directors, "Don't let me be good. Have the gumption to challenge me to be great, because I want to be great. says Sky P. Marshall, who plays Bates' colleague on Matlock. I can imagine directors coming in for one episode, how scary that could potentially be, giving Kathy Bates an adjustment. But she goes into it wanting to consistently be a student, to learn and be pushed. Bates sums up her Matlock gig simply, "I'm doing everything I was trained to do," she says. "We've now crossed the two-hour mark of our interview. It's not that I hit every note exactly right, but I get to try, and I keep trying, and I keep trying." It's pouring outside now, and Bates's niece, Linda, has been waiting patiently to take her home. We agree to pick things up on Zoom a week later. When we reconvene, Bates logs on from her couch with a list. "I started to fret about some things that we had talked about," she says. She's worried about how she discussed the way her appearance was treated in Hollywood. It's embarrassing. Linda's dog climbs on her head as she reconsiders. "But I think that's fine. I can be embarrassed about it." She mentions some other details she'd rather keep private before smirking. "Is this weird, somebody telling you what to write and what not to write?" Strangely, it's not. "This is the person I've come to know. Thorough, sensitive, magnificently conversational." One topic Bates is comfortable exploring. She lives with depression and has spent her life better understanding her mental health. "It used to be anathema. I needed help when I was a teenager and it wasn't talked about," she says. She questions what she wants to say on the record. "I want to be really careful because I love my mother. We had difficult times growing up. It was not her fault." Bates's father attempted suicide in his early 80s, just before Bates began playing her breakthrough stage role as a suicidal divorcee in Broadway's Night Mother. That overlap was tough on Bates. There are times, too, when her depression comes on strong. It's always there underneath, almost like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. "You can feel really good, and then there are times when you get swept under," she says. "I don't want to get out of bed. I don't want to see anybody. I don't want to talk to anybody. All of my closest people know when it's happening. They back away." I ask if there's anything else Bates hopes to clarify before we wrap. "I wanted to talk about how difficult it is to talk about what I do," she says. "It's what I've spent my life doing, and I don't know how to talk about it." She pauses, and after a time, decides to stop worrying about how this piece will be received. "People are going to think what they think, right?" she says. "One thing I can promise is that Bates's inner life helps her go where she goes on screen. It's at least partly why she can terrify us in Misery, break our hearts in Primary Colors, find that jagged human comedy in About Schmidt, and so on. Everything she does is inside her. air of danger. Fancy flyers have created a huge boom in private jet travel, no longer the exclusive province of Fortune 500 companies. Elon Musk or Taylor Swift. Yet for all the allure, flying private is a rather dangerous luxury, by Jeff Wise. Opening photograph shows a private jet awaiting takeoff. They called her Gypset. The name, a combination of gypsy and jet set, wasn't one she'd come up with herself. She'd gotten it from the writer Julia Chaplin, who coined the term in her 2009 book Gypset Style, to evoke the vibe of bright young things who waft from Sailuta to Tangier to Topanga Canyon, crafting eclectic necklaces and draping yurts with Hermes cashmere. Athletic and glamorously bohemian, with glacial blue eyes and a silver ring in her nose, Gypset embodied her nickname's ideal, always flying off to go skiing or hang out backstage at a rock show. Her given name was Lindsay Gleisch. She lived in Huntington Beach, California, a short walk to the Pacific Surf. Being a Gypset is an occupation best suited for the independently wealthy, and Gleisch wasn't that. She had a normal job, designing websites for Dollar General, but she was beautiful, friendly, and free-spirited. In mid-2022, when she was 30, Gleisch met a man 5 years her junior, Reese Linders, on a ski trip to Mammoth. Linders was a pilot who was building his flight experience in turboprops and small jets. He took her on jaunts to Las Vegas to see shows, to Arizona for her birthday, to the Bay Area for more music. It was an intense but short-lived relationship. The two called it quits in spring 2023, but they continued to see each other occasionally, as exes sometimes do. On a Friday night in July, Gleisch was in her apartment getting ready to have dinner by herself when her phone rang. It was Linders. He was about to take a spur-of-the-moment flight to Las Vegas with two elder couples. The relationship was personal and professional. Linders was working for Manuel Vargas, but the two were also friends. Perhaps that's why Linders was allowed to ask Gleisch if she wanted to tag along. They could make a night of it, hit some bars, and then fly home. What did she think? She said yes right away. It was a nearly 2-hour drive across the mountains to get to French Valley, the airstrip Linders was departing from. A slog, but better than sitting at home on a Friday night. The plane, a white Cessna Citation II jet with red and tan speed stripes, took off at 9:18 p.m. from the exurbs on the far side of the coastal mountains. Linders, the pilot in command, sat in the front left seat. To his right was his co-pilot, 32-year-old Vargas. Vargas had a successful real estate and landscaping business and flew helicopters, jets, and prop planes for both business and pleasure. He and his wife, Abby, had 5 kids, ranging in age from 1 to 14, and lived in a sprawling compound in Temecula. Abby was sitting in the back of the plane with Gleisch and the other couple, Alma, 51, and Abe Razik, 48. The Raziks had 7 kids and owned several car dealerships in California and Arizona. The plane touched down at 10:04 p.m. at Harry Reid International Airport, and the group headed north to the Strip. Gleisch and Linders made their way to the Alley Lounge on 66, a wood-paneled bar in the Conrad Hotel at Resorts World. Linders had a drink, but by FAA regulation, he shouldn't have had any. Gleisch was under no such restrictions, and by the time the group headed back to the airport, she was buzzed enough to be over the DUI limit. So were Manny and Abby Vargas. The Raziks had enough alcohol in them to be on the verge of passing out. At 3:04 a.m., while they were waiting to take off, Gleisch texted her friend Lindsay Mausner a picture she'd taken looking out over the Strip. "Love that someone's awake, because Vegas also never sleeps," Gleisch wrote cryptically. on the East Coast. Mausner wasn't awake, though, and the text she read in the morning marked the last time she ever heard from her friend. Flying private has always held an edgy allure. It is a true satanic temptation, as former Vanity Fair editor Tina Brown recently declared in her Substack. "I am convinced it's the single most seductive experience in the world," she wrote. "You realize there is no one you wouldn't kill, betray, or sleep with to ensure a lifetime of lux relief from the armpit of mass transit. Personally owned or chartered jets are potent signifiers of over-the-top wealth, redolent of exclusivity and power. Yet they evoke all of the darker aspects of that privilege. There's no better way to encapsulate your status in 30 seconds of cell phone video than to show yourself sliding into a Gulfstream at Teterboro and sliding out at Ibiza's private jet terminal. You'll also be embodying extreme inequality and destroying the environment." And over the past few years, owing in part to the pandemic, PJs have morphed from a mysterious elite privilege into an object of popular fascination and marginally more widespread accessibility. Where commercial aviation has been making headlines for all of its chaos and agita, PJs seem to offer freedom and comfort. And though they were once mainly tasked with shuttling executives around, jets are now used by wealthy individuals like the family station wagon. It's all about the creature comforts that Mr. and Mrs. Hedge Fund have grown accustomed to, one aircraft broker told me. These jets are being marketed as pied-à-terre in the sky. They are also unmistakable markers of status. Anyone can flaunt a Dior bag or splurge on a dinner at Per Se, but if your ride is a Gulfstream, you are the real thing. When Donald Trump isn't flying Air Force One, a modified 747 jumbo jet, he flies a 757 with his name painted on the side. Elon Musk flies multiple Gulfstreams and is famously tetchy about the fact that they are publicly tracked. Taylor Swift owns a Dassault Falcon, but also charters other jets. Former Google CEO Eric Schmidt enjoys his Gulfstream so much that on average, he flies more than once per day and spends one-sixth of his total time flying. Next photo, Free Spirit. Lindsay Mausner and Lindsay Gleisch attend a Goose concert on December 17, 2022 in Broomfield, Colorado. Celebrities love to flex on TikTok with images of themselves sitting on jets. A subtler way to signal your name, to signal your belonging, is to drop the name of one of the FBOs, or fixed base operators, providing lounges and concierge service at private aviation terminals, such as Millionaire, Signature, and Jet Aviation. There is no greater hazard than the offer of a Gulfstream to foster dubious associations, Brown wrote in her newsletter, mentioning the private jet usage of the Obamas, the late Barbara Walters, and former President Bill Clinton. Now publicly remorseful, he partook of Jeffrey Epstein's plane, as did Trump. "The one thing flying private doesn't offer is more safety. In most things, the ultra-rich are much more protected than the rest of us. They even live longer. But when it comes to air travel, those who fly private are actually at a significant disadvantage. The collision of an American Airlines jet and an Army helicopter in Washington, D.C. in January was the first fatal commercial crash in the United States on a domestic carrier since 2009. Meanwhile, fatal private jet crashes happen three times a year on average in the United States, with most of them killing everyone on board, according to a federal accident database. The terms private jet and business jet refer to any turbine engine aircraft that isn't used for scheduled airline flights, with most such aircraft being smaller than regional jets and seating between 4 and 19 passengers. So far, 2025 has been unusually deadly. The crash of a medevac jet in Philadelphia on January 31st killed all six aboard and one on the ground. On February 10th, a private jet belonging to Motley Crue's Vince Neil careened into a larger business jet in Scottsdale, Arizona, killing the pilot. Why is the jet set life, with all of its promise of exclusivity and freedom, so much more hazardous? The answer is related to how wealthy people are allowed to take investment risk that average people aren't. Because they're considered sophisticated, it's assumed that they understand the hazards and can bear the consequences. Likewise, if you have your own plane, you're in a position to check for yourself and gauge whether it is safe. Commercial passengers, by contrast, can't be expected to assess the safety of their air carrier. The job of the Federal Aviation Administration is to protect the unknowing public, says Fred Lee, a former pilot who conducts seminars about air chart operations with the agency, which is responsible for regulating all non-military aviation in the United States, though the military does follow FAA rules when operating in national airspace. Sophisticated customers, in other words, are expected to understand the dangers, so the rules can be looser. If they make a dumb decision, that's on them. The thing is, if you give people the opportunity to make bad decisions, it won't be long before some of them do. In March 2023, Dana Hyde and her husband, Jonathan Chambers, took their teenage son, Elijah, on a two-day trip to New England to look at colleges. The pair were something of a Washington power couple. Hyde, 55, was a lawyer who worked in the Obama White House and then was tapped to head the Millennium Challenge Corporation, a government-funded development agency. Chambers was a former Federal Communications Commission official who wrote rules there for cable TV providers, then left to join a consulting company. Driving to New Hampshire would have taken 8 hours. But Chambers' company had a corporate jet, a super midsize class Bombardier Challenger 300 that comfortably sat up to 9 passengers. Another well-known Bombardier aficionado is Swift, who frequently flies on a Bombardier Global 6000. The model had a good safety record, but the pilots had limited experience in the aircraft type, each having less than 100 hours of flying time in it. Normally, if one guy's a newbie, you'd want to have one guy with at least 100 hours, says Mark Beaumont, a retired pilot who flew Citation jets. But if you don't have that luxury, and it's allowable within the regulations, well, that's what you've got. As a private pilot myself, I can attest that becoming fluent in all the nuances of a particular aircraft is very helpful for safety and takes time to master. Next photo, high tragedy. A field near the landing approach at French Valley Airport in Murrieta, California, where a Cessna crashed on July 8, 2023, killing all 6 passengers. Inexperienced pilots have become a prominent hazard of flying private. The surge in PJ popularity has run headlong into a conflicting trend, a shortage of skilled pilots. The military trains far fewer aviators than it once did, and fewer young people dream of the skies. Meanwhile, airlines have raised salaries, luring pilots from smaller operators. The situation has been years in the making, and it is incredibly challenging, says Cheryl Barden, CEO of the recruiting agency Aviation Personnel International. You can't make a pilot overnight, and we didn't make them for so long, and now we have a big gap. Pilots who once would have happily spent their careers flying private jets are instead getting pulled up into the airlines as soon as they've logged the required number of hours, leaving behind those with less stick time. And that has safety implications, It's like a teenager driving your car, says Barden. You've had so much more experience, and that gives you situational awareness and knowledge. That doesn't mean every teenage driver is a bad driver. They just don't have the same level of experience. A large proportion of private jet accidents in recent years have involved careless piloting of a type that is rarely seen in commercial aviation. In 2021, the pilots of a Challenger landing in Truckee, California, rushed their landing unnecessarily, lost control of their airspeed, and corkscrewed into the ground. Almost 2 months later, a Citation crashed while trying to take off from Farmington, Connecticut, because the pilot forgot to disengage the parking brake. In January 2023, an Embraer Phenom light jet veered off the center line during takeoff, wobbled in midair, and crashed after hurrying to depart from Provo, Utah before a snowstorm, killing the pilot. As Hyde and her family readied for takeoff from Dillard Hopkins Airport in Keene, New Hampshire, on March 3, 2023, their pilots gave off hints that they weren't fully on the ball. According to the preliminary accident report, during the standard pre-flight inspection, they failed to notice a bright red cover had remained in place over the pitot tube, a probe that measures the aircraft's speed and whose malfunction famously caused an Air France crash over the Atlantic in 2009. Only after they'd started accelerating down the runway for takeoff did they see that their speed wasn't registering on the instrument panel. They aborted the takeoff, and the captain got out to remove the cover. The second takeoff attempt was successful, and the plane climbed as it headed south. But just 2 minutes into the flight, the control panel began to light up with a slew of warnings, including AP stab trim fail and AP holding nose down. The pilots didn't fully understand what was happening, but the system designed to even out aerodynamic forces in the plane's tail wasn't operating correctly, and so the autopilot was struggling to hold the plane's nose down. Over the next 6 minutes, the plane continued to climb as the pilot struggled to figure out what was going on. In emergencies, pilots are trained to refer to checklists that give step-by-step instructions of what to do. Unfortunately, in this case, the co-pilot pulled the wrong one. Its first item was to disengage the autopilot, but when they did that, the nose shot up like a tug-of-war contestant whose opponent had suddenly dropped the rope. Alarmed, the pilots pushed the nose back down again, then jerked it back up again when the plane plunged too steeply. Back in the passenger cabin, Chambers was strapped into his seat, but Hyde wasn't. According to the final accident report, as the plane porpoised violently, Hyde must have been thrown around the cabin. In the few seconds it took the pilots to regain control, she sustained fatal blunt force trauma. The plane made an emergency landing at Bradley International Airport near Hartford, where an ambulance met the plane and rushed her to the hospital. Hyde died that evening. At least Hyde and Chambers had at their disposal a relatively new and top-of-the-line aircraft. Many private flyers don't. The lower end of the market is dominated by smaller, less technologically advanced aircraft, many of them quite old. And as the accident data makes clear, the smaller and older the plane, the higher the risk. Planes like a 7-passenger Cessna Citation Jet Model 525 cost $6 million new, but a 44-year-old model like the one that Gleich boarded can go for $500,000 or even less. What you get is a plane whose navigation equipment is generations older and less capable, whose airframe has withstood decades of use, and which is often flown by less experienced pilots. All of that affects safety. Since the start of 2020, there have been 16 fatal private jet incidents in the United States, according to the federal database, with almost half of them involving citations, which make up just one-third of the private jet market. And of those involved in incidents, the average age of the aircraft was 33 years. A separate risk factor associated with citations is that most of them can be flown by a single pilot. That makes them more affordable to operate, but can be dangerous if the pilot has a problem in flight. In January 2021, 72-year-old Richard Belke was flying his Citation alone over Oregon when he apparently fell unconscious and stopped responding to air traffic control. The plane fell into a spiral descent and crashed into mountainous terrain. Crash investigators noted that while the pilot suffered from no diagnosed medical condition, his age, gender, high blood pressure, and hypertension placed him at risk for a heart attack or stroke. Something similar might have happened in one of the most widely publicized crashes of 2023. On June 4th, a Citation carrying 49-year-old Adina Azarian, her 2-year-old daughter Aria, and Aria's nanny, Evadne Smith, took off from an airstrip in rural Tennessee and headed north toward Long Island. In the cockpit was a single pilot, Jeff Hefner, a 69-year-old former airline captain who'd flown more than 25,000 hours for Southwest before hitting mandatory retirement age. How Azarian had come to be on the flight was a strange tale. A prominent commercial real estate broker in New York City and the Hamptons, she had met John and Barbara Rumpel, wealthy Republican donors from Florida, after they'd inherited a commercial building on Irving Place. The Rumpels took a shine to Azarian because she reminded them of their own daughter, Victoria, who had died in 1994 at age 19 in a freak scuba accident. Victoria and Azarian would have been around the same age, and the Rumpels saw an uncanny resemblance. It wasn't enough to be friends. The Rumpels legally adopted Azarian, even though she was 40 years old, self-supporting, and had a living mother. Azarian desperately wanted to have a child of her own and spent 3 years undergoing fertilization treatments before finally succeeding in giving birth to Aria in 2020. The Rumpels bought a 23-year-old Citation and assigned Hefner to fly it. The plane made it easier for Azarian and Aria to visit them at one of their homes in North Carolina. On June 1st, the jet took its first flight up to Long Island, picked up Azarian, her daughter, and the nanny, and zipped them to North Carolina. After a 4-day visit, the three boarded the plane to return to New York. 15 minutes after takeoff, as the plane climbed through 32,500 feet, air traffic control asked Hefner to level off at 33,000 feet. He did not reply. The plane climbed to 34,000 feet and followed the route programmed into its autopilot. Once it reached Long Island, the plane turned onto the heading for Long Island MacArthur Airport. Instead of descending, it continued to fly in a straight line toward the southwest, a course that took it directly over downtown Washington, D.C. The Air Force scrambled 6 F-16 fighters from 3 bases to intercept, their sonic booms shaking windows below. When the pilots reached the Citation, they saw Hefner slumped over in the cockpit. Soon after, the Citation ran out of fuel, entered a spiraling dive, and crashed into a forest in central Virginia. Speculation as to why Hefner fell unconscious has focused on 2 possible causes. One is that being an older man like Belke, he suffered a sudden overwhelming medical event. If that's the case, then the 3 passengers in the back plausibly remained oblivious right up until the fatal descent, since they made no attempt to call for help. Another explanation is that the aging jet might have suffered a mechanical failure, such as a faulty valve or a malfunctioning pressure seal that caused the cabin to depressurize as it climbed to altitude. In that case, the lack of oxygen would have caused everyone on board to pass out in a matter of seconds. Speaking to reporters after the crash, John Rumpel said that a depressurization would mercifully have put his daughter and granddaughter gently to sleep. "That's the end of my family," a grief-stricken Rumpel told the Washington Post. "It's just my wife and I now." There's a final factor that makes commercial aviation safer than private jet travel: the rules. Until the advent of the DOGE era, strict government regulations enumerated in hundreds of pages of fine print cover everything from the stowing of tray tables to announcements concerning lavatory smoke detectors. Private jets operate under less stringent sets of rules. One set applies to flights conducted for personal use without any paying passengers. These so-called Part 91 rules have very few restrictions. The Hyde and Azarian crashes were both Part 91 because they were flying in jets that belonged to their family or company. Another set, called Part 135, governs air charter operations. Part 135 rules are stricter, requiring, for example, that operators obtain a document called an air carrier certificate, which ensures that the aircraft meet minimum standards. The rules also limit the number of hours that pilots can fly per day. A pilot flying with a co-pilot can fly no more than 10 hours at a stretch, for instance, while an airline pilot can fly no more than 8. Though lax compared to commercial aviation regulations, Part 135 rules can still be costly to comply with, and unscrupulous operators are often tempted to skirt them, for instance, by skipping the lengthy process of obtaining certification. A few years ago, the FAA teamed up with the National Air Transportation Association, an aviation industry trade group, to create the Safe Air Charter Team to better inform pilots and passengers about how illegal air charter operations pose a serious safety hazard to the traveling public. Nevertheless, the problem has continued to worsen, especially during the pandemic, with the FAA investigating more than 100 cases each year from 2020 to 2022. Unfortunately, there have been so many really clever people who have tried to find subtle ways to circumvent 135 regulations that the FAA has had to be increasingly crafty in coming up with ways to stop them, says Lee, the former pilot. According to documents filed with the FAA, the plane that Linders and Vargas were flying that night was one of several belonging to a man named Michael Morris of Imperial, California. Morris told the Associated Press that Vargas was the manager and lead pilot of his flight company and that he'd agreed to lend the plane to him because he knew Vargas was responsible. "Vargas was my pilot for 2 years," Morris told me when I reached him by phone. "He described Vargas as a great guy and Linders as a wonderful kid, then declined to talk further due to pending legal action." In early 2022, Linders flew to Virginia for pre-purchase inspections of 3 aircraft that Morris was in the process of buying from a company called Central Virginia Aviation. "Reese flew 2 or 3 times. We hung out a little bit at the airport," says Dennis Harrop, who worked with Linders and Vargas on the sale. One thing that stuck in Harrop's memory was Linders' description of the long hours he was flying. "I remember him telling me how tired they get. I'm running ragged," Harrop recalls. And Linders was happy about it. "He's excited because he's building twin turbine time, which is what any young pilot dreams of." "He would say that he had been up for like 3 days straight," says Mary Bolton, a friend of Gleich and Linders. "I'm thinking, wait a minute, don't they have like regulations about this? I'm so confused. How is this happening?" In quick succession, Central Virginia Aviation sold Morris 3 airplanes, two Citations, and a turboprop King Air. I assumed they had a lot of charter business, Harrop says. As the Citation crossed back over the Mojave Desert, Linders dialed up the automatic weather reporting system for French Valley. What he heard wasn't good. He had been planning to land under visual flight rules, meaning he would just navigate to the runway by sight. But within the last few minutes, fog had pushed in from the coast. Visibility was now only 3/4 of a mile, with clouds hovering just 300 feet overhead. Linders would need to rely on his navigational instruments to guide him. He radioed air traffic control and filed a new flight plan. He'd had to deal with conditions like this before and knew the procedure well. But things were different now. It was late, he was tired, he'd had at least one drink, and his co-pilot was legally intoxicated. He had a load of passengers in the back whose Friday night euphoria was turning into Saturday morning hangover. They descended into the clouds, the beacon on the tail sending flashes through the enveloping gloom. 1,000 feet, 800 feet, 500 feet. Linders peered through gloom looking for the runway. The plane had reached its destination altitude of 250 feet, the minimum altitude beyond which a pilot may not descend without the runway in sight. According to the last weather report he'd heard, he should have been out of the clouds by now. But in the meantime, the clouds had gotten lower and thicker. Unable to see anything, Linders gave up his attempt to land and performed what's called a missed approach, throttling up the engines and climbing back up into the night. When a pilot can't land at an airport due to unfavorable weather, the next step is to find a nearby airport where conditions are better. The nearest alternative at the moment was Hemet Ryan Airport, 13 miles to the northeast. From there, it would be a half-hour Uber ride to French Valley Airport, where everyone's cars were parked. There was also another option, to go around and try again. Writes aviation safety expert Ian Twombly, many pilots have crashed trying to refly the same approach, no doubt after convincing themselves the ceiling or visibility was going to somehow rapidly improve. Whether or not he understood the danger, Linders opted to go again. He banked into a right-hand turn, then leveled off and began his second descent. Once again, he plunged into the clouds and watched the altimeter tick downward as he slid toward the runway. The altimeter ticked down to the decision altitude. Linders couldn't see the runway, but kept descending anyway. The Citation impacted a gully 800 feet short of the runway. Linders and Vargas were killed instantly. The broken fuselage tumbled forward another 100 feet into a field of scrubby grass. The impact threw the pilots' bodies another 200 feet, where they came to rest on a roadway, still strapped in their seats. The other passengers' bodies were scattered closer to the fuselage, which was quickly engulfed in flames, fueled by spilled kerosene. The National Transportation Safety Board issued a preliminary report on the French Valley crash in August 2023. It noted that by the time Linders made his second landing attempt, a thick fog over the runway had made the chances of success essentially zero. It made no mention of illegal air charter operations or the effects of fatigue. That kind of detail is typically left for the full report, which takes a year or more to complete. But there's a limit to how effective government action can be. No agency can mandate that people use good judgment. The spate of recent private jet crashes has revealed a lot about a mode of travel that is otherwise cloaked in privacy. Often, it turns out, the purpose of the flight is strikingly inconsequential. Azarian flew to spend 4 days with her adoptive parents. Hyde was on a 2-day trip to look at colleges. Gleisch was looking for something to do on a Friday night. You have to wonder, Would these people have made those trips that way if they'd understood their choice to be one of risk over convenience? The normalization of flying around in private jets leads the public to believe it's safer than driving on the freeway, says Amy Fulmer, one of Gleish's friends. The only time they learn otherwise is when it's too late. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis. Kevin Bacon, the bondsman actor on Marriage, Bullshit, and his perfectly unique nose. What is your idea of perfect happiness? A family dinner, candlelight, lots of laughs. What is your favorite journey? The last leg of any journey home. What do you dislike most about your appearance? My nose looks like a two-car garage. What or who is the greatest love of your life? She's in the next room. What is your most marked characteristic? I guess the two-car garage. Let's put it this way. If I'm walking through a crowd and want to avoid being recognized, I just cover my nose. No doubt your caricature will be featuring it. Which historical figure do you most identify with? I truly don't think about historical figures that much. Maybe it's no accident that I've rarely played one. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? Probably our first dog. Her name was Jane. Pretty great life. Free spirit. Although she was accident prone. What is your greatest fear? Food and a sink drain. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? I can't stand the way my voice will crack if I'm making a speech. I hate public speaking and the emotion it dredges up. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Lying. Let's not call it untruthful or factually inaccurate. I don't even call it bullshit because I like bulls and bulls need to shit. So you can't hold out against them. Let's call it what it is. Lying. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Physical appearance. On what occasion do you lie? Sometimes it's necessary backstage after a screening or when someone just played a song for you. Which living person do you most despise? It's a growing list, but I wouldn't write it here as we live in an age of weaponized retribution. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Like, as in I was like. What does that even mean? It's noncommittal. What is your greatest regret? Not practicing the guitar. When and where were you happiest? I have to believe that my happiest days are ahead of me. Otherwise, the future looks miserable. What is your current state of mind? It's always shifting, even in the flash of a moment. Anxious, excited, peaceful, hopeful, and back to anxious. What is it that you most dislike? Questions about our marriage. I hate to take decades of partnership and distill it into a soundbite. What do you consider your greatest achievement? My family. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? I'm going to take this opportunity to say I don't want to come back. I don't believe I will. I want to do my best while I'm here because I believe that when I'm gone, I'm gone. What is your most treasured possession? I guess an old guitar, but I'm not too attached to possessions. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Whenever I see a parent who has lost a child to war or shootings or disease, that seems like unimaginable misery. What do you most value in your friends? They want nothing but friendship. Who are your favorite writers? Cormac McCarthy, Barbara Kingsolver, Stephen King. How would you like to die? Without pain. What are your favorite names? Travis and Sosie. I'm not kidding. I love these names. They also happen to be our kids' names. We got the names off crew list of movies that Kira was shooting while pregnant. And that was the Proust Questionnaire with Kevin Bacon. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.